Dharani Yagala, 3rd of April 1967.
Personally, I was not very impressed with the Constitution as a permanent arrangement. I thought it was of great value in getting our people ready for full self-government, in that they learnt how to conduct themselves as parliamentarians up to a point and so forth. But as a system, I don't think it would work. That was my own feeling.
Won't work? In what sense?
Well, I think there should be a clear-cut line between the government and the opposition. Here, where they work in committees, you don't get that feature. In fact, there was no opposition under the Dunmore Constitution, except for one man, Dahanayak, who sort of became an opposition in all matters to all people there. That was a sort of personal idiosyncrasy of his own. Apart from that, there was no clear-cut distinction between the government and the opposition. And I think the position wasn't very effective. All sorts of arrangements were made in committee and so on. And there was no adequate debate or proposal when it came up. One committee proposal would be accepted by the others as almost as a matter of case of give and take. You agree to my proposal, I'll agree to yours, sort of thing. You see, I don't think the system was satisfactory. It was a permanent.
And didn't the committee tend to work in compartments without liaison and coordination, or at least adequately?
Definitely. Of course, there was the Board of Ministers meeting, and they were fortunate in that during the war they became a cohesive body, because the officers of state, you know, the three policemen as they were called, built them up to be a sort of cabinet. They were fortunate to that extent. I think if not for the war, they would not have even... I think that if not for the war, there wouldn't even have been that degree of cohesion. However, that was my feeling, that it wasn't really a good permanent arrangement for the country.
And there were complaints that it was slow and cumbersome.
Well, I'm not prepared to say that. I think if they wanted to, they might have acted with very considerable expedition, because the chairman of those committees did manage to achieve a position very similar to that of a minister today, although the Constitution did not really warrant it. That again was due to the officers of state trying to build them up during the war. As Mr. Drayton once told me, when he was attacked by Mr. D.S. Hiranayake, he said that they had really gone out of their way to build up these chairmen into and confer on them a status of minister for which there was really no warrant, because they felt that during the war the representatives of the people should try and run the country, although actually under the Constitution they didn't have all those powers.
Yes, and wasn't it possible for the minister to take a decision on his own and present a fait accompli to the committee?
Well, you know, under the Constitution, he was only a chairman, and in every matter he was supposed to act with his committee. In point of fact, that just was impossible, with the result that he used to do everything and face it before the committee. That was the standing arrangement.
Yes.
for which there was no warrant in law.
What sort of man was Brin?
He was one of the ablest, well, in those days he was undoubtedly the ablest of the British officials out here, I think. He is an exceedingly able man and a very experienced man. Very experienced man. And a very sincere and good man, I think. Towards the end, he fell out with Mr. B.S. Senanayake, but I think there was understanding there, and he was suspected of being very imperialist when he wasn't.
On what issue did they fall out? I think it was a rather small matter. Wasn't it?
Something so small that really I can't remember. I was present when the row took place. It was something exceedingly small in the cabinet.
Oh, a row in the Board of Ministers?
Yes.
Yeah. I asked this about Drayton because I know you were not present earlier, in the pre-war years. But in the pre-war years, Wedderburn and Cyril and others didn't get on so well with the ministers and with B.S. in particular as Drayton and Nine Blankhouse. Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
Because anyway, Jennings made
yes.
a mistake.
Yes.
And therefore, I was wondering whether there was something in the character of Drayton and Nine and something in their attitudes which enabled them to get on better with the ministers than the older.
Well, the old people were the civil service types. They knew the politicians. Most of the politicians had started with small beginnings, you know, and in the eyes of those civil servants, these were small people. Of not great importance. Drayton, Nahil and those people, they came when people like Mr. G.S.A. Nack had built themselves up into positions of authority, and they took an objective view of these people and found their men of merit and treated them with high regard.
Do you think the stress of war and this policy you have mentioned earlier also
help
towards the greater cooperation?
Well, so far as this policy goes, you must remember that there was Mr. Tyrrell as Chief Secretary and Mr. Drayton. And it was Mr. Drayton's policy to really build these people up more than Mr. Tyrrell, Sir Graham Tyrrell.
Now, Graham Tyrrell was before the war, Drayton.
Am I right?
Yes. There was Tyrrell, Wedderburn as Chief Secretary, and after Wedderburn, Woodman was his wife.
Woodman.
And Drayton was legal secretary then.
Yes, that's right.
So I suppose it was then that...
It was Woodman then and not Tyrrell. I'm sorry, yes. Quite right. Quite right.
And then Drayton became Chief Secretary
Chief
and
Secretary.
Woodman was
that's
sacked
right.
by...
Yes, that's right. Drayton worked very, very closely, I think, with the Admiral, what's his name, Leighton. They were good friends, and I think Leighton probably was advised by Drayton, relied on Drayton, more than on most of the other people.
Yeah. And where did Caldicott lie in the arrangement?
Caldicott, those days, Caldicott himself was a very good man, and I think they worked rather closely together, with Caldicott playing a minor role. I think Leighton and Drayton were the big people who ran the show. Caldicott rather stepped down for those two. Of course, Leighton always was in a position to push Caldicott aside. He had that power, which he never exercised. Yeah, he had a latent authority to take over the government.
What happened after Drayton's row with B.S.? Did that lead to his...
Well, all not good publishing. Actually, the row took place about a week before I was due to go to the House of Commons. And Drayton and I had worked together both in the legal secretary's office and afterwards in connection with the new arrangements also. And he gave me a letter to take to Downing Street asking for a new job, which I took. And he got it. And he left, you know, also now.
Yes, sir.
I took the letter to one of the authorities in Downing Street, saying you can't get along. I don't know.
Someone told me that Drayton was very sort of disillusioned and bitter as a result of it, because he...
I don't think he was disillusioned and bitter, but he was extremely sorry. Actually, I think he had tears in his eyes when I last spoke to him. that he had been misunderstood after having really done an honest job of work, honest and sympathetic job of work.
But what I found rather surprising was that he was not very popular with the European citizens.
Yes. He socially and so on, he didn't mix very much. He was a rather reserved, hard-working, slightly dour type of man.
Yes, I see.
Yes.
And then Nile
was just reversed. He was an Irishman, you know, very Irish in the
area. But that should appeal to the citizens.
He did, yes. He had a lot of citizens. He had a lot of, he didn't get into any trouble. He got along all right.
This point you meant about the necessity of a clear-cut division between the opposition and the government. Isn't it debatable in a sense that the opposition sometimes becomes a factional opposition, opposing?
Yes, just for the sake of opposition. True. At the same time, what I really wanted to say about the Dalma Constitution was also the sort of arrangements of power. You know, it was a case of bargaining. Frequently, it did not depend on the real merits of a matter, which are threshed out properly. There is a good debate between the government and the opposition, but more a matter of bargaining. And, you know, there is a tendency for one executive committee not to attack a proposal of another executive committee just because it's not to offend the executive committee.
And how would you analyze Mr. Dahanayake then and his political career since? Because he would seem to have been a radical then, but...
I think Mr. Dahanayake had grown a lot in stature. He put up a very able performance those days, but he was generally not treated with respect or he did not carry much weight. He was more a joke. But over the years, he had both matured, I think, and grown in a sense of responsibility. And to counterbalance that, I think people have come to regard him with much greater regard now for me.
And turning to your experience in England, I presume you spent a year or so there?
No, it's a matter of months.
Oh, I see. What was your impression of the working of the parliamentary system there at that stage?
Oh, I came back with very high regard for their system. For one thing, the impression I had was the great sincerity of the people there. Their great ability, there was a tremendous lot of talent there. People studied their subjects when they came. People didn't just stand up and talk for the sake of talking. If a man got up to speak, he spoke with authority after being briefed on the subject, probably by a large number of people. So debates were...
And did you feel that the standard of the committee work there, I mean, extra parliamentary but very essential sphere in my opinion, the standard of the committee work was very high?
Very high.
And how does it, how would you compare Ceylon committee work here?
You see, to begin with, I really don't believe a parliament can work till there's a sort of abundance of members. With a small group, a parliament can't work. Now they've got 600 odd members. Now there are men who practically take no interest in doing on the floor of the house. They are committee men. These people in the public accounts committee and all. And they don't worry about the sittings. They are working in the committees. While the sittings are on, they may come for a division or something. But they are working in committee. They are prepared to devote their time to it. Then they specialize. Then they have superb officials. The House of Commons staff is magnificent staff. Practically all Oxford and Cambridge men exist. Maybe all of them. And extremely highly trained, extremely dedicated. And a, you know, extremely superior officer. And these men guide these committees. With regard, they do a great deal of the useful work.
In Ceylon, then, is the House of Representatives staff given the same scope to guide these parliamentary committees?
No. They are only the clerk and his assistant. Those are the only two staff officers in the House, except the Sergeant at Arms. That's different.
So did you have anything to do with the committees at all?
I said clerk of every committee. Well, that is too much. I mean, the Public House Committee alone sits during the whole year. It needs study, thought, exploration of the groundwork stuff before it's placed before the committee and so on. Well, I did the best I could, and I think we did a very good job in the Public House Committee. But there's an enormous lot more which, if they had a specialist there, could have been done. I had to steer every committee, whether it's privilege or bill or select committee or whatever it is.
What exactly is the clerk's role? Are you allowed to voice any opinion on the subject, or what do you mean by steer?
Well, that rather depends on the standing of the individual as to the amount of rope the committee is prepared to give him. If you have the confidence of the committee, they will practically let you even ask the questions or witnesses or whatever it is that they are, as frequently I did, because if it was a case of sort of cross-examining a person, I might take over a matter like that because, you know, I've had a training in that sort of work, and then the committee would let me. And of course, you guide the committee in the sense that you decide the lines on which they have to investigate. You think out who should be summoned, say in a particular, say a budget leakage or something like, you've got to think out what to do, and you summon the people and examine them in front of the committee.
So the procedural aspect is entirely in the clerk's hands?
Yes.
Did you find...
It depends largely on the chairman also. He may take matters over completely if he's an active chairman.
And were there any particularly active chairman whom you can recall?
Well, in the Public Accounts Committee, unfortunately he died, Mr. F.H. B. Cock, with his great interest in finance and so on. He had matured into a very fine chairman of the Public Accounts Committee. He was more interested in finance than probably in larger issues of public policy and so on. But I think he was a exceedingly good chairman. We've had a number of good chairmen, but you know, I can't say they are outstanding lawyers and so on.
Did you find that sometimes your duties clashed in the sense that there were two committees meeting at the same time? And
because I arranged them all. One would be rather pressed with work.
And parliamentarians in general, did you feel that they were not very interested in committee work, but more interested in the parliamentary
debate? Yes. That is very much so here, where, unlike in the House of Commons, with 600 people, a debate, you may find only 20 people on the floor of the House. No one claims to want a forum, I think. Those are the people interested. The others just go walk out. Because these are the people who know the stuff and who are debating it. In Ceylon, unfortunately, every member wants to talk on every subject and long speeches. The standard is low. People get tired of listening to that sort of speech. And there is that very big difference between House of Commons and Ceylon. As one, well, if you only look at, address on the debate, a debate on the address of thanks, you will find that even the Prime Minister doesn't talk more than about 20 minutes or 30 minutes. Our big people want half a day, and they feel most hurt if they're not given half a day to make their thoughts clear.
You mean you arrange the times too?
Yes. In big debates, yes.
But isn't this in a way unavoidable, because our politicians, depend on their constituencies, and I always have to have an eye on their public image and the representation they provide for their constituency. And this
but
is
the moment you import that certain element of insincerity into their debate, it becomes transparent, you know, that they are talking to something else. And it's not a debate. You see. That is why everything is done, you know, under the British system, to stop that sort of insincerity, talking to the record, talking to the public. That's why they will not broadcast proceedings. That's why they keep a chamber so small that it's a little friendly group, you know, talking to each other, instead of having a rostrum member, you know, declaiming and all that. The whole idea is really to promote this sort of discussion, that atmosphere where people are induced not to make speeches for third parties.
Isn't there a public gallery?
We have a gallery. Even a gallery is, under the British system, kept quite small. For that reason, you must have a gallery, of course.
And if I may ask, what sort of man was Moore?
Well, I think he was, I mean, don't put it on record, but he was nothing more than a civil servant of a rather humdrum type. And I don't think he rose to any great height. He did his job, but he didn't
block the negotiations and such.
Oh, I never heard that mentioned.
And what do you think of DFL's generalship at this crucial stage for
brilliant? Brilliant. That's the only word I can use. Whether it was, I suppose it was an instinct. He never slipped up once, to my knowledge. I mean, these things like getting rid of Drayton and so on, I might have disagreed, but. Well, I'll never forget his winning over Ponnambalam. You know, a brilliant, able fellow like Ponnambalam. I mean, he was practically, he didn't move a muscle. He won Ponnambalam over so easily. Formidable opponent.
How did he do it?
Well,
yes, DS's control seems surprising because one can't help feeling that there were many other ministers in his first cabinet, Ponnambalam later on, and then Bandaranaike, who felt that they were intellectually superior. But yet, they were under his...
Bandaranaike alone did not feel so very much under his hand. The other day. Bandaranaike... I think, well, I won't say felt he was DS's equal, but very near.
Is it true that he had been promised the succession? That in 47, when they got his group into the UNP, they had virtually promised him?
Oh, yes. He told me so himself.
Then isn't it also true that he was being edged out and blocked within the cabinet?
Yes.
In that sense, his resignation was a fairly honourable course. Its timing was perhaps...
switch that over to you.
Coming back to the point of negotiation, his relationship between OAG and DS, would you say that DS was always the captain of the ship?
Always.
I mean, I was wondering whether Gogia Pasha, as he was called, helped to set DS on the right...
Yes, good advice. And he advised Bandaranaike. Well, Bandaranaike relied a great deal on him. I mean, for instance, he capitulated completely during the Tamil riots and gave the whole thing to Oliver Gunatelapa. I asked him, why are you doing this? I said, you are bringing the post of Governor General into dispute. Governor Generals don't do this. They are like constitutional monarchs. He said, what am I to do, Ramp? I have no one else.
Don't you think on that occasion he was following the easier path, because any audience emanating from this strong arm policy would attach itself to the Governor General and not to...
Oh, no, I don't think. I don't think it was that. I don't think it was... I mean, maybe to a slight extent. That wasn't quite that. It was just that he had no one else to turn to. He was a man of ability whom he had begun to trust when he started. He had absolutely no faith in him.
Yes, I'm surprised that he kept Oliver on. Isn't... I mean, he would have known that Oliver at India's time as a minister, Oliver had helped to undermine his position as
I don't think that's true.
Oh.
Except this, there's a row and D.S. came for advice. He advised D.S. how to tackle the fight. But he didn't go out of his way to down with Bhattacharya, I don't think. Bhattacharya didn't like him, didn't probably thought ill of him. So I don't think he actively wanted to down Bhattacharya like that.
Isn't it true that one of the ways in which Bhattacharya was being undermined was this separate development of rural development societies to parallel and counteract his village communities?
That was done on the advice of Sir Francis Murmuri. D.S. told me and Sir Francis, I was present. He said, Bhattacharya is trying to create a government within a government. And this measure was taken to counteract that.
And under whom was it? Under which minister?
Oh, minister was it?
Oh,
was it under D.S. himself?
I must check up on that.
That was definitely that contention.
And isn't it true that as Minister of Transport, Sir John also could hinder Bhattacharya?
Well, that was one of Bhattacharya's complaints to me. He said, I can't get a hospital built. This chap just come to market, the PWD won't build it. What am I to do?
You mentioned insults in the cabinet. In what way?
You know. I wasn't the secretary of the cabinet, I don't know, but I think he wasn't treated with the respect that a number two in the government should have been treated, you know, that's all. And most of it was done through men like Kothalal, you see. D.S. would put them up to do it. They were all his friends in the cabinet. Poor man was all alone, right? Mm-hmm.
Ratnayake was not strong enough to keep him in the cabinet.
He had John Dalsai, when he was it to take it
for him. What about it? RSS was Bhattacharya's man.
RSS is the one man Bhattacharya was never forgave. Very strange. Till he died almost, Bhattacharya talked ill of RSS. RSS was like a brother to Bhattacharya. When Bhattacharya was a bachelor, he and I lived next, our family houses were next door to each other in Silversmith Street. And we are
Silversmith?
Yeah. We lived next door to each other. Our two families are related then. And he used to come and live there. RSS. And yet he was also bought over.
Isn't it correct to say that from early on, Bhattacharya and RSS worked closely together from the 1930s? Who was the senior partner?
Oh, Bhattacharya. This chap was like a
hammer.
Pardon? RSS was like a hammer.
Oh, I see. But wasn't he senior to Bhattacharya in age?
Maybe.
No, that's why I asked, you see.
Maybe.
So reverting to the point of the question of the negotiations with the British, 45, 46, 47, one of the civil servants here, a Britisher, commented that OEG always was a step ahead of the British, of the colonial office and other people there, and in fact that he even terrified them. That
the negotiations from this end were very skillful. That was now before my time. But I know they were very skillful and successful. For instance, D.S.A. Naka said he was boycotting the Dharma Constitution. Yet he was entertaining them and getting them to do what he wanted.
The Solvary Commission.
Solvary Commission. So you see, it was like that. Because those people also were just going out of their way. I mean, they probably knew they were being led up the garden path, whatever it is, and yet they would not disclose it. They just wanted to do it in a nice way, and they were determined to do it.
Someone told me a story of how D.S. is reputed to have put up very intelligent men of his own as peasants, whom, you know, directed the leaders and all to take them to this man, take the commissioners to this man, and meet this particular percentage, you know, so that they could have the vote and things like that.
Well, I have no doubt that during their visit here, they got a very high opinion of our capacity to rule ourselves. The men they met were intelligent, and I think they must have thought they were dedicated, you know, and so on and so forth. I think they went away, the feeling is wrong not to let these people govern themselves.
Thank you.
That impression was well and truly made on their mind.
When you were in England, did anybody comment on DS and OEG and the people here in a sort of relevant way? Any colonial officials or others you met?
I can't say during the time of the House of Commons. You know, these colonial officials just disappear in a place like London. You don't see them.
And have you any knowledge about the talks at Yamuna in 47? You know, they were thinking of forming a non-executive government because the UNP didn't have a straight majority. And an opposition group met at
Yamuna is Sri Nisanka.
Yes.
No, Sri Nisanka. I know nothing except what Sri Nisanka told me, which is that he went with an offer to Bandaranaike and begged of him to form the government. And that Bandaranaike could be great ease upon the government, but he said no way. That he had promised to.
Oh, could Bandaranaike have formed it with ease? I thought it might be.
So Sri Nisanka said, I don't know how the voting strength lay. Mm. Definitely, he said, Bandaranaike. And Bandaranaike voted with him. He did. And you know, the moment you are in the saddle, everyone comes to you. It's a most remarkable thing. If you can just get into the saddle, begin if it was you or your six men that you nominate. But for quite apart from that, you buy over this. Uncommitted fellows, you know, there are heaps like that.
And there are a lot of independents then. So don't you think that in this sense, DS made a big mistake in pushing his dynasty system, if I may call it that?
Well, that is, I mean, universally regarded as so, you see. I mean, he wasn't perfect. He had his little weak points. Most unfortunate that this should have happened. And probably, but I mean, also if he had behaved in a different way, if he wasn't at a certain stage apprehensive of what's going to happen to him, but just stayed on and cultivated good relations and so on, it would have come in way. Without all this, you know, trouble that the country has been put to as a result of this clash.
And who? I mean, can you tell me something about the formation of the SLFP in 51 after Bandaranaike crossed over?
Well, you see, what he did was, once he made up his mind, I told you that interview, after that he went and did a tour, right? That's my recollection.
After he met you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he revived the old local government, what do you call it, the Singala Mahkama,
yes.
All his connections, which were almost dead. And he found a big response. Then he made certain language demands with great publicity, which just could not be met by the air. And on that he resigned. You remember that, don't you?
He resigned on that.
He resigned.
Oh, you see, yeah. First prepare the ground before resigning.
But all within a very short time, maybe 2 months. Not that. He was picky.
Was he disappointed at the extent to which he is supporters in Parliament didn't cross over with him?
He sort of, he told me, rather sneered. And, oh yes, the other man who crossed over was old Rajapak.
George R. Silva
and Rajapak.
Lakshman?
No, that man from the south, that quiet man.
Oh, I see.
Lakshman's uncle.
And then Sri Nisanka also joined his newly formed party.
Sri Nisanka was not in Parliament then, I think.
No, but wasn't he one of the founder members? Outside.
He was from the old days.
Don't you think that Bandaranaike showed considerable sagacity in the battleground he chose and in the crisis he chose from the point of view of getting power?
Yes. It's a matter of getting power, yes. There's no question. And I think in all new countries, you'll get the same feature. In Malaya, I think it's coming on now. In India, it's still due to come, I think. You know, these rather extreme views, which are extreme things, which are put to starving people who hold on to it as their last hope. You see, when people are poor, you dangle different things, you say, the official language is Sinhalese, all these chaps will get civil service jobs or something like that. They may not believe, and still they back that man. Something, you know.
But, 55. Well, I mean, 51 he formed the party, but 52 elections, his party hardly made any impact. even in his crime. How would you explain that? This is Dudley fighting this election.
Just after the death, isn't it?
Yes.
Wait a minute, let me see the sequence now. Old man died, Dudley became Prime Minister, Dudley resigned.
No, Dudley dissolved Parliament.
Dissolved Parliament.
And won the election.
Stood for election again.
Yes.
I think that was really, you know, tremendous wave of sympathy and so on. Old man death and all that.
The emotional element there. But even 55, as others know, are elections, three candidates, by election, UNP, SLFP, LSSP. SLFP came up over third in Alupnora, which is a rural area, but 56 is of the polls. So there is a strange element there. It would seem to have, the cry would seem to have become...
We have an idea that there was more organizing by the Buddhist priest
afterwards.
And that organizing, I personally have never got to the bottom of. I know that, for instance, Bernard Arroyo Harrison, he was beaten. And he said, you know, I thought I was right on top. I did hear that there's a strange Buddhist priest living at such and such a temple, making a few speeches, that sort of thing, Buddhist priest here and there. I never thought they'd sweep the world like this. Seemed to be all done by who they are, by wondering how it works.
There's an extra book speaks to Perumana, which was a Pope in France. I don't know who the politicians who marshal them are. But someone said that many of these priests...
I think these chaps like Dias and so on, you know, St. Joe Dias and all those fellows. Probably this was the ultimate fruits of a long endeavor. Quietly.
But wasn't 56, in a sense, more anti-UNP than pro-SLFP? Difficult, of course, to measure it, but...
Well, I do believe if the SLFP wasn't there, the UNP would probably still have lost, yes. I think that's quite likely.
But looking back over the UNP rule, 47 to 56, what would you say to...
No, look at you. You're just winding up now. Yes.
Color of the thread. Do you know anything about this issue of DSA Nigel's death? Because it seems so improbable that he and Lord Salisbury had anticipated any such eventuality?
No. Then he definitely had.
He had.
And he had given, who was the Governor General?
Salisbury. And Alan Rose was acting.
Definite instruction that if anything happened to him, to call on Dudley. Failing Dudley, call on Oliver. Failing Oliver, call on J.R. Failing J.R. to call on Sir John. John was fourth.
So it would appear that...
Now the order between Oliver and J.R. I can't remember. But those instructions had been given. And Salisbury stuck there.
Verbally or in writing?
I don't know. My informant was J.R. Hey, I'm telling you...
No, but this is the...
Now, I don't know how you're going to use it.
No, I'm not going to publish it.
It's just for your information.
Because then it would appear that not only the old man, but regard to the whole UNP, they considered Sir John a good second in command, but not a person who should lead the party.
Or a man who could be used and, was very, really not fit, but useful in, fighting others and that sort of thing.
I think
Jaya was number two. Jaya was number two. Dudley, Jaya, Oliver, Sir John.
So the point being that though he was leader of the house and one would expect him to succeed DS, most of the UMP would seem to have been against his being the Prime Minister. Isn't that...
You know, if he had become Prime Minister, they'd have come to him. There's no doubt about that. If there was a voting, there would have been a split. I don't know how it would have gone. There. It's very difficult to say. I think that is the one person. But very difficult.
Of course, the Premier makes no bones about his...
Yes.
I read it and he gives a list of those who were against him, a petition, but that number was not very large. But the impression I get from I got from Mr. Ratnayak was that most of the MPs were for Dutch. But of course, this is retrospective.
I'm not so sure. He was very popular.
Sir John
was very popular. He has an attractive personality. And UNP is very popular. But there was a lot of canvassing men. He was dying in the nursing home itself. I saw it myself. You know, where Baldies was dying. Some people felt he was good enough. And I think they went around whispered.
Well, one thing must be said in favor of Dudley, he was against it himself at the start.
Against what?
Against this campaign at the start.
I don't suppose Dudley played any part in the campaign. Mm. At all. Mm. I don't think. I've never heard it said that he did. Did Sir John suggest that in his book?
No, he doesn't. No. He makes no bones about his, on this point, about his hostility to Senaker, J.R. and Oliver. He calls them all sorts of things. In fact, can you recall the small contretemps when this was published, the Premier's Takes?
Premier's Takes were published when I think I had to leave the country for something. Just that little. I know he had left a copy of that book for me with someone who said he left with him for me, but he never gave it.
But even then, it would appear it was not so much Dudley, but Solbury and others who pressed Dudley to ask Sir John. Yes,
Sir John and I went to the coronation, that's right. Together.
He was in Washington.
I can't remember.
But why did Solbury not like Sir John? Because that's very clear.
You think he did not like? Well, I suppose his manners and so on. Sir John, as well as his capacity and various things, put Solbury off. One can imagine a man of Solbury's type thinking Sir John is not quite the man to be.
Was he rather some conservative, old school type?
Solbury, yes.
In fact, I read J.L.C. Fernando's little pamphlet, and he mentioned something about State Council days when D.S. went to England. And they wanted a temporary chairman about drawing dust out of a hat in Mahadeva's house.
Temporary chairman of?
Temporary vice chairman of the board of ministers. Correa and Sir John and SWRD were the candidates.
They do lost, didn't they?
They do lost.
No, I didn't know that. I would have thought that. Would have been neck to neck. I would have put SW higher than Correa.
Yes, what sort of chap was Correa? I haven't got a picture.
I have had no experience personally. I came into this game, I think, just about when. When did he leave? He left for a diplomatic, wasn't it? Diplomatic appointment.
I'm not certain.
Or was he falling ill? His reputation was good, very good. Certain people made some allegations, but not accepted by most people. His reputation was very good, as a good, solid man.
Drive?
Drive.
But what do you think of George E. Silva and his place in Sinan Party? I don't know if you knew.
He carried little weight. one of the many who supported DS. He was also one of Bandar, right?
In stress.
Originally.
I turn it to 56 and all that it represented. I mean, can you recall the incident where the house was invaded by a mob? Do you think that was a bad precedent? I mean,
it was indicative of Bandar Nayak's abdication of giving up all sort of discipline. It was a start. Well, they had sort of gone wild at that time.
They had.
Yes. And,